Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Welcome, you're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. That lovable little guy over there, well, that's Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
How are you today, sir?
Very well.
Another week in the can, heading off deeper into October. The month is turning out beautifully for me. I got to tell you, I'm really excited about something, Tim.
Yeah, what's that?
So this week, we're heading to the Chicago Paracon.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yep.
The 2019 Ghost Conference in Chicago. And I was asked by my former high school to come give a presentation to students the night before.
Oh, very cool.
So I get to go to my original high school, a block and a half from where I grew up in my haunted house, to go talk to students. And I don't know how many there'll be, but I just saw today on the Twitter, Tim, which is a part of the social medias.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they posted about it and said, come on out and be a part of this and hear scary ghost stories and Dave Schrader from the Holzer Files. So I'm pretty excited to do that. That's kind of a weird feather in my cap. And that takes place in the same week that I appear in an issue of TV Guide, Tim.
They still sell that, Dave?
They do. TV Guide still on newsstands, and there's an online version of it as well. But
well, that's what I'm looking for, online stuff. Yeah, yeah.
It's and I'll share it with you. But yeah, it's pretty cool. I to me, that's my dad was like, oh, they want you to talk at your old high school, and you're in TV Guide. Finally, I get the old man's approval. 13 years of paranormal talk radio, a well received published book by an actual publishing house, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Being on Paranormal State, being on Ghost Adventures, Haunted Hospitals, and Holzer Files, nary a notice. But the TV Guide, my dad's all into it now.
Well, that's something he can relate to. Now, if you get it in large print, that's even better.
Oh, I'm going to get him one of those. I think they do sell the TV Guide large print because that's the wheelhouse, right?
Yeah.
So this is cool. I know it's the little things in life that excite me, Tim, but now, TV Guide.
If you could just get yourself in Reader's Digest, I think that would top it for the old man.
I didn't tell you this, but I did have a joke published in 1986 in Reader's Digest, Tim.
Did you?
I did. I still have the issue kicking around. I'll have to dig it out and and scan it and put it on the social medias, Tim, so people can see my foray into writing back then.
Well, there you go. Now you've truly made it.
Is that the trifecta?
That is, yeah. Yeah.
It's Reader's Digest, TV Guide, and talking at my former high school.
You've got it. You've made it.
Yeah, we just got to get Winona State to hire me to come back and talk to its students one night, and then it all will have fallen in line.
Well, that's a slam dunk. You just go to the UPAC committee and tell them you'll do it for a hondo and a hot dog, and you'll pretty much be in. Yeah.
Hey, I'll drop the hondo if I have two hot dogs.
Well, there you go. You're in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Make it happen for me. Speaking of making it happen, it's been a busy couple of weeks with the kickoff of the Holzer Files on Travel Channel. The second episode just passed. This next week, kids, tune into it. Holy sheep dip. We're at the Whaley House in San Diego, California. Tim, first time in 13 years this has ever happened to me, but I get physically assaulted by a ghost.
Yikes.
Yeah, I get violated, but they didn't show that part of it. Something actually physically reached through my pants and pulled my underwear down, I guess is the only way to say it.
Yikes.
I don't know how else to explain it. Yeah, and it was defiling me. It was making a joke of me. And then later on in the, and I don't think that's going to air because it's such a weird, awkward moment. It left me feeling really uncomfortable, to be certain. And then later on in the episode, you guys will see what happens when we call out the spirit of the Whaley House that we think we uncovered and its violent reaction to that. So that's this week on the Whaley House episode of the Holzer File. So I hope you guys will tune in. But I also got to do Salem Live, and we talked briefly about this yesterday. And Haunted Salem Live, very cool 4-hour live ghost hunt. First thing in history to kind of combine shows from the network all in one thing. It was kind of like the old Battle of the Network Stars, Tim. Remember that? When they'd take TV stars from all the different networks and they'd have them compete in Olympic Games?
Yeah.
We just took paranormal shows, Kindred Spirits and the Ghost Brothers and Portals to Hell and Holzer Files, put them all together to ghost hunt together on national TV and had a great time. And you and I both pointed this out yesterday on the show. One of my favorite moments was during the Portals to Hell investigation with Katrina and Jack Osborne, and our guest today, Michelle Bellanger, was there. And they brought in a woman that claims to be a descendant of one of the original witches that were killed during the witch trials. And she begins having a very interesting moment on camera. And Michelle Bellanger did something that I will forever go down in my book of that is the coolest fucking thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Everybody else is giving these looks like, what the hell is happening? And this could have been an easy meltdown throwaway scene. And Michelle comes in and owns this moment and takes this, de-escalates the moment, brings this woman back into reality and does it in such a deft, swift way. It was awesome to witness. Jamie, Kaler, and I stood there watching the monitors as Michelle brought this down because we're thinking, oh, this is a debacle. What's going to happen now? And then Michelle begins to talk this woman off this paranormal ledge and all is right with the world and evens out. And then I believe I'm not 100% sure, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
They cut to commercial. They come back. The woman's missing.
Yeah. Yes.
I thought I saw a trickle of blood on Michelle's lip. I could be wrong.
No, I don't think that's how
it did on that woman during the break. Michelle Bellanger is most widely recognized for her work on television's Paranormal State, where she explored abandoned prisons, haunted houses while blindfolded and doing it in high heels. A leading authority on psychic and supernatural topics, her nonfiction research in books like The Dictionary of Demons and The Psychic Vampire Codex have been sourced in television shows, university courses, and numerous publications around the world. She has been a guest through the years on our programs with Darkness Radio and Beyond the Darkness Now. It's great to have you join us, Michelle Bellanger. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Great to catch up with you.
Moment. Yeah.
That, Michelle, seriously, that could have been, I mean, it was fascinating to watch, right? Because you don't know what's going to happen. Car wreck TV is always great when you watch live TV and somebody starts going off the rails. But to me, honestly, the highlight was watching you take her down in a very polite, kind, loving way. And I thought it was great because when I asked you about it, you're like, but to her, Dave, that could have been a very real moment. And I gained so much respect for you at that point because like many of the viewers, I'm thinking she's nuts. This chick is nuts. And instead of you treating her that way, you gave her respect. You earned the respect of the audience. And it was one of the highlights of Salem Live for me. So well done.
I've had to de-escalate stuff like that. I teach a lot of psychic self-defense. And at the end of the day, even if you don't believe what's going on with a person, the best thing to do in that moment is to get them out of the space, because it might be paranormal. It might not be paranormal at all. And if they're having a reaction that is that severe, you just need to treat it like an emergency and shut it down.
And you did that. You did that very, very effectively. But in that moment, I mean, when you're watching this unfurl, are you concerned, oh God, this is paranormal? Are you more concerned this is an unbalanced person? Or is it maybe the trifecta? You know, this is a weird situation. We've got an unbalanced person and the supernatural all working in conjunction.
Psychically, I didn't feel what she was feeling, but I didn't feel that I had in that moment the place to say you're faking or you're not. I really just wanted to get her to a place where she was more comfortable. Because we all know that what I can say is people who become attacked like that, if it was a legitimate attack, they're often open because they've got poor boundaries. So people who have poor boundaries are also people who can have other problems mentally, emotionally, etc. And at the end of the day, really, like, it's not a matter of was it real or was it not. It was real enough for her that she needed to not be there.
Agreed. And, you know, that's a weird moment, you know, to see somebody having this. And I've been at places where, like you, I don't feel like there's anything paranormal going on here, but this is scary as hell that this person is reacting this way. But you can't always discount it, because if there is, you know, if there is something going on with them, what would it look like?
Yeah. Well, you know, some of us have had experiences, and you know how some of the stuff is incredibly subjective. So you feel a ghostly touch. Nobody else feels anything. And you're either a liar, a fake, or there's genuinely something that is only targeting you. And when you're put in the position of how do you judge? For me, the bottom line is, does this seem like it is dangerous for the person who's experiencing it? If yes, then de-escalate.
Very cool. Salem. This was an amazing opportunity to be there. I visited Salem 10 years ago and I did a conference, but I didn't get to get out and see things. And you and I and some of the other castmates went to the Salem Witch Museum and had a chance to kind of do that. And that was the first time I really got a dose of the history, the real history. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on it. I mean, are they a tourist trap, or is that history spot on to what really took place there?
Most of it. So I'd been learning about the Salem Witch Trials since I was a kid. I think my public school was really weird. We learned a lot of weird paranormal stuff. So like the Giles Corey story had been something that stuck with me since I was 12. I think that there's a little bit of an air at Salem of like Disneyland, but with pointy hats. And it is wrapped around a great love for the history of their city and a respect for what that meant. I mean, there's some irony. I don't know if irony is the right word in the fact that they are making money. Like it is, witchcraft has become a commodity there. And when you take in light of the tragedy, people being accused of being witches, what I can say is it would really suck to be a ghost who was killed during the witch trials and then now has to live in this town where witches are just everything, everywhere. Like
that is weird.
Yeah, I mean, that would be just weird.
Well, that's what I was thinking. And, you know, I'd love your insight on this. I mean, here we are trying to communicate with the spirits of these tortured souls that were, you know, killed in heinous ways, hanged, crushed, and yes, I didn't say burned at the stake, folks, because that's not a thing. You know, that's a Hollywood machination. I know it took place over in Europe. Was there ever any burning at the stake in the United States that you're aware of?
No, because the witches were punished in accordance to civil laws, and that was hanging. On the European continent, they were burned because it was a matter of the church.
And seeing the torture that's taken place, or as you said, but then I often wondered, they lived a life where they were wrongly accused of doing something, witchcraft. Now we're kind of doing that now, witchcraft. I mean, this would have been considered witchcraft, trying to commune with the spirits, talk with them using equipment. Is there a conundrum, do you think, for the spirits on that side to want to relate to us? Because in essence, time is irrelevant to them. And here we are actually using the things that they were accused of being able to do at that time in order to communicate with them.
I think it would inhibit some of them from wanting to communicate because we're coming at them with stuff that they died to prove that they were not doing. Spirit communication was absolutely one of the things classed as witchcraft in their time. It's highly likely with Tituba, if she was teaching the kids anything, communication with the ancestors was pretty high on the list based on what Tituba's like lineage, her bloodline religion would have been.
And for listeners that are not familiar, maybe didn't catch that, Tituba, now this is kind of the linchpin, isn't it, of the case? This one person is kind of where we see the germination of this story explode. Can you give us a little background on Tituba and who she was and how her story got blown out of context?
So Tituba was the nurse to the Putnam Girls, and I believe that she was from Barbados. She was a slave, African-American descent, and she'd been telling the girls stories about what she knew about the world. There's a high likelihood she was teaching them harmless little spells and things as well. Didn't think much of it, probably until Daddy found out and then took exception to it. So Tituba did not get killed during the trials because she confessed. And that's another thing that a lot of people don't know about the Salem witch trials. If you finally broke down and said, yes, sorry, I was meeting with Satan in the woods, kissing his bunghole and signing pacts, they'd like slap you on your wrist and you didn't hang. It was the people who refused, just absolutely refused to admit to having anything to do with witchcraft, who went to their graves. And I think that's what the conundrum for us as investigators would be, is you have these people who were willing to die to prove that they were not witches. They had no truck with that kind of stuff. And here we are using spirit communication to try to talk to them.
And the reason, if I understand this correctly, the reason that they were put to death and that many of them were kind of pointed out as witches. Listen, if you had property that you wanted their property and they wouldn't give it to you, if you pointed the finger at them and they admitted they were a witch, they would lose their property, so you would gain. If they didn't, they would be put to death and you would gain. So a lot of this was just ways to get rid of the jealous lover, get rid of the people that you want off the property, get rid of anybody that just kind of irritates you or crosses their eyes at you wrong. So that's pretty much how these accusations, 150 in total, or was there more?
Oh, I forget, because it was not just Salem or Salem Village, but it was all up and down New England. And if we want to expand it to the European witch craze and the witch trials that occurred in the British Isles, it's, by some accounts, it's millions. I did my undergrad thesis on the European witch craze, and there's stories about like entire villages in Germany that once neighbor got done with accusing neighbor, the entire village was empty. It was just a ghost town. Almost everybody had been killed.
Okay, so we know that a lot of what took place in Salem was jealousy, pettiness, and all of that. Is that what would happen with blaming somebody in European countries as well? Was it that same greed factor that we find in this, or were there other deeper, more fascinating rooted elements to why these people were pointed out as witches?
There were a couple of layers to it. I mean, first, it was a really convenient way of pointing out the people who were your outliers, your outsiders in your community. It's why our classic picture of a witch is a crone, an older woman who was a widow, who had no male in her life to be the property owner. Was an easy target to try to get all of the stuff that she had, because women weren't supposed to have property, but she would inherit it. You know, basically, it was a land grab in a lot of ways, but it was a land grab against people who didn't fit in society and who didn't play by the rules. Any of the outsiders, any of the strange, people with mental illnesses. And there, the one thing is, some scholars will say there is absolutely no proof whatsoever that there was actual witchcraft. And yet, anything that was pagan, pre-Christian in practice was identified as witchcraft in that time. And there were certainly things that were practiced. So were there actual witches who got caught in any of these? There's a chance that there were. There's a chance that there were people who were definitely practicing some of this stuff. There's a class of people called cunning men and cunning women, and they were basically homeopathic healers, herbalists and stuff. But at that time, that also was witchcraft.
Right, and here are the people during the daylight would be pointing them out and shunning them as witches. But man, if there was ever anything wrong, they were the first ones that people went to. Isn't that right?
Yes. And the irony is, things that were accused of being witchcraft in the hands of the lay people, the villagers, like textual amulets. There was a big thing like writing certain words. Actually, the St. Benedict medal came from this tradition of scribing sigils and using usually Latin little prayers as kind of a protective talisman. if you were a regular person and you had something like that, and you were a regular person writing something like that, that was witchcraft and that was punishable, usually by death. But if you were clergy and you did the exact same thing, it was okay. The number of textual amulets that many of the witch finders had on themselves to protect themselves from the witchcraft is it's ironic that they were killing people for doing the same things that they were doing, just outside of the bounds.
Well, that's always been the case with religion, right? What's okay for us is not okay for the rest of the world. And I'm not beating up on any one religion. That's just the case across the plane, is that we'll punish others for doing something similar if they're not doing it to our gods.
Yeah, well, pretty much. Like, what you're doing looks weird to me because it's in a language I'm not familiar with, even though basically you're saying the exact same thing.
Could you imagine if Time Portal opened and Cotton Mather got a look into 2020? You know, what the hell would they think now, seeing what we have going on and the way people treat it and what Salem really looks like? If they, you know, they were so worried about witchcraft, it's been pretty much embraced there since, I got to guess, the 60s, 1960s through, as kind of a touristy area now. That would have to be quite a shakeup and probably put things back in a perspective of what they were really dealing with.
Well, especially because Salem has become this sort of like unofficial, well, actually at this point, official Mecca for actual practicing witches, as kind of a way to reclaim their identities, as kind of a way, I think, to rebel against the small-mindedness that caused the witch craze. So there are actual practitioners. I mean, there's tourist stuff there too, and fun t-shirts and whatnot, things inspired by Bewitched. But there are people who practice magic. And if you know which shop you're going into, you can get a genuine spell.
To become challenged as a witch, there were 20 people in Salem that were put to death for it, 19 by hanging and one by pressing, which is what they basically put you on a flat surface, then put a board on you, and then begin piling rocks on top of it and heavy objects until you basically just kind of crush to death, correct?
Yep.
And the whole concept with that, and that was Giles?
Yeah, that Giles? Was Giles Corey. Giles. I'm pretty sure it's Giles.
And what's funny is, like, he was one of the biggest protagonists, right? Wasn't he one of the one that was always behind pointing out? I have to be careful. I keep wanting to say fingering people. That doesn't have the same meaning as it once did when talking about it. But he would be one that was always pointing the finger of righteous indignation at these witches. And then he ends his life in a way. But you've got to give the guy some credit. When his time came, he refused to yield. And they were willing to let him go. He just had to admit he was a witch. And he refused to give that up.
He was a really problematic person. And you know, he dies, you know, basically as a martyr to his family in a lot of ways, because he refused to say yay or nay to either. If he put in no plea, they couldn't take his stuff. And the general belief is that he died so that his family and his inheritors would keep all of their things. But before that, there's a high likelihood he beat one of his farmhands to death. So the guy's got a temper. When he clearly got caught up in the hysteria, because he even bore witness against his wife. He kind of like had second thoughts about it, but he's an odd figure. And in a lot of ways, probably the most human figure, because a lot of people, when you've got like that kind of madness of crowds, it's easy to succumb to the misinformation and the emotion and be swept up in it. And Corey definitely was.
With the 20 people that were killed, the 150 plus that were tried, and boy, to see those prison cells was unbelievable. Some of them were like a closet, and there was no bathroom. They just lived in their own filth, and they were given bread and water to live on. So if they did acknowledge that they were witches, sometimes a slap on the wrist was not such a light slap on the wrist.
No.
Some spent their entire life living there. John Proctor's wife, I can't remember her first name. Was it Mary?
I think it was Mary Proctor.
Right.
Somebody, Sarah, Mary, Elizabeth, so they run together.
Right. Elizabeth Proctor, I think, might be it. But she was in prison pregnant.
Yeah, so, if you were a even if they decided that you were a witch, they didn't kill you for the sake of the baby. But getting put in that prison, there were, when I was doing the, there were at least four other people who died, including, I think, a guy whose last name was Toothacre, which that one really stood out. They died in prison. So, right. So they weren't hung, they weren't pressed, but they were effectively killed by this whole thing.
How long from start to finish in Salem specifically was this witch fervor?
Oh, didn't it? I'm trying to think, because I think the first hanging was in June. There were still hangings going on through October. Giles Corey died in October. I remember because it was just a couple of days before we filmed. It was relatively quick. I don't know if it lasted much longer than like a year or so. I'm really bad with numbers, though. So this
right, no, no, I, that's fine. Yeah, I couldn't. I know it was like a short period.
Yeah.
No, how about in Europe, was it a flash as well, or was that something that was sustained over a much longer period of time?
Much, much longer period of time. The 1500s and 1600s, there was still some stuff going on in the early 1700s, although that was less the witch craze. The whole vampire thing that went on in Europe was sort of something that happened on the tail end of the witch craze. So rather than killing their living villagers, they just dug up relatives that they suspected of basically doing the same thing that they accused witches of, which was, you know, cursing the land and killing the livestock, killing people through disease and whatnot. And it just switched from a living person being responsible to it to someone who had died and was sending their spirit from beyond the grave to do it.
Witchcraft in general, has seen rises in popularity in the way it's been looked at. You know, you brought up Bewitched. That certainly kind of gave a new look to witchcraft and took the glamour, you know, put in the hands of realizing that witches are not all, you know, Margaret Hamilton from The Wizard of Oz, and that witchcraft is something, although it was, you know, televised for entertainment, that it was a bigger portion of people that were involved in this and fascinated by it. And that was a magical community, a very Harry Potterian kind of world that they lived in, but they coexisted in the realm of humanity. But that's really every walk of life has kind of had a version of Wicca or witchcraft through the centuries, hasn't it? From all the way from the past through the Bible, there's mentions of witches and sorcery all the way through to today.
Well, yeah, I mean, so Endora, you know, her Samantha's mother.
Yes. Agnes Moorhead. Yeah.
Yeah. She's named Endora because it's a biblical. I think it's in Samuel. King Saul, there is a witch of Endor, and she is what's called a belly whisperer. She talks to spirits and she pulls them up from wherever it is they go. And so Saul is going to try to pull up one of the dead patriarchs to talk to him. And it's where a lot of our ideas of what witches are and aren't supposed to be doing comes from. Outside of like the Leviticus passage of thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. So it was, I guess my point is like, it was acknowledging where some of our ideas of witches come from and then sort of like turning them on their head, particularly in that very, I mean, she was a very fascinating character.
Right. And they kind of gave all the different aspects, but it's cyclical nature of pop culture and entertainment. I mean, it seems that every few years, there's some new iconic version of witches that are represented. And in your estimation, I mean, are any of them getting the basic concepts of it right? Did Charmed, the original series, were they on the right path? As you know, understanding that, you know, these guys are dispatching demons and fighting monsters, but for the most part, what they did and how they treated witchcraft, was that close?
Each time we cycle through with having a real witch on a fictional television series, they seem to do their research a little bit better. I mean, obviously with Samantha and Bewitched, you don't just wiggle your nose and make spells happen. But once they started to talk about Wicca, say in Buffy, with Willow, and with Charmed, when they present witches primarily as people who have connections to natural powers, that magic is definitely a part of who they are, that most of them choose not to curse or otherwise harm people, but that most of their spells are more for protection and for helping themselves and their family, sometimes prosperity. They get closer every time.
Religion versions of it as well. I remember, and Tim, I think you reported on this with the Supernatural News at the time, when shortly after 9/11, people turned away from churches in droves, regular Christianity and regular church versions. But Tim, wasn't it something like they had seen an uptick in the practice of witchcraft and Wicca by like 30% or 40% after 9/11?
I don't remember the exact percentage, but yeah, there was an uptick in practice of Wicca and other pagan religions. That's correct.
Why do you think that there was such a change in the way people perceived witchcraft, especially in this newer cycle, and the concepts of witches?
Witchcraft and folk magic are spiritual traditions that are essentially unmediated. You are the person who is doing something to try to bring about the change in your world and in your life. That's actually one of the classic definitions of magic, is exerting your will to create change, either in the self or in the exterior world. Whereas most organized religion is mediated. You don't have direct access to God or to miracles or even to the end result of prayers. You have to go through someone else to do it. And weirdly, you usually have to pay that person. Although you're putting the money in the coffers of the church, it still is costing you money to have access to God and to your holy places. With witchcraft, it doesn't. It's a perfectly personal thing. You sit in your home. You don't have to go to a church at all. You create your little altar, light a candle. All of the same steps of prayer that a Catholic might go through are recognizable in witchcraft, but there's no intermediary. It's you and the divine, whatever shape that takes.
What is the true definition and separation between something like Wicca and witchcraft?
So Wicca is a specific religious expression of witchcraft in the same way that Catholic is a type of Christianity. And even within like witchcraft is a broad umbrella, and that itself is underneath the umbrella of modern paganism and neo-pagan beliefs. So Wiccans follow the Wiccan Rede, and it harm none in word, thought, or deed, do as thou wilt. And that's sort of the blanket of their ethos. They tend to be referred to as fluffy bunnies by some of the other practitioners of witchcraft that see things in a little bit less black and white, and more that sometimes you make choices to do magic that seems harmful, but in the end is a greater good, in the same way that sometimes you cut things out of a body to cure cancer. But in addition to Wiccans, there are Gardnerians, Alexandrians, Dianic witches, who are very, very firm on like witches are women only, the end. And each different sect within the sort of like modern witchcraft movement has its own interpretation on what witchcraft is, who can be a witch, how what symbols and things you'd use to express your magic, and who has access to magic. There are some traditions that believe it is a lineage and a lineage only. So if you're not born a witch, you can't do this stuff. And then there's plenty out there that are like, nah, if you want to do it, do it. And if you want to call yourself a witch, nobody's going to gatekeep you.
That's interesting, too, the concept of witches and male or female. The term warlock came up. I thought I'd read that it was really kind of invented for like Bewitched, just to have a name to give a male witch. Do you know any kind of history on the genesis of that term? And is that really a warlock, a male witch, or is that a Hollywood creation?
I was Wiccan for a very short period of time. It was a little bit too white light for me, but I was taught warlock used to mean oath breaker. And I will say in the late 80s and early 90s, to call a male witch a warlock was a huge insult. However, there's been a lot of, you'll hear this word reclaiming, taking words like witch that used to have terrible connotations and redefining them by living it differently in your own example. So I do know some people who are male practitioners of magic who prefer the term warlock. And it varies from person to person. But there are some who will be very, very insulted if you just call them a warlock, which is a gender neutral term. You can have male witches and female witches and witches that fall anywhere in between.
All right. Now, getting back into the idea of this, was, you know, taking herbs and spices and things from the earth to create healing and potions and such, the concept of magic, as we see with Samantha twitching her nose or the sisters on Charmed doing their incantations, what do we know historically, Michelle? Is there ever any real, quote unquote, poof magic associated with witchcraft, or is it basically intention setting, evocation, meaning that you're what we consider in the new generation as positive affirmations, you know, just newly packaged? How do you differentiate between all of that?
Honestly, it's really hard to, because what a lot of like modern light workers do, if you're a Reiki practitioner, if you're into holistic healing, you might not call yourself a witch, but a lot of that is what witches do as well. I think that the words that we use kind of divide us, because there's an awful lot of folks who otherwise are doing, you know, spirit communication, magic, we'd even call it necromancy, but they're paranormal investigators, so they don't think of it like that. You know, as for whether or not there was like, you know, poof, like flashy Hollywood magic, I think the thing that I go back to is during World War II, there were several magical groups in Great Britain that were active that were trying to basically create what are called thought forms, kind of like a constructed spirit to help shore up the protections of England against the attacks. And that had a precedent back in the 1800s. The poet W.B. Yeats and the Irish revolutionary Maud Gonne, in their letters, exchanged a number of... They were basically brainstorming this idea of going to the sacred sites, the old pagan sites in Ireland, and trying, through magic, to resurrect the spirit of the land to throw off Irish rule as a kind of magical way of rebelling against... and freeing Ireland, rebelling against English rule and freeing Ireland.
Well, and was that what was referred to as the cone of power, the witches that would meet in those holy spots and try? I know that they actually called upon them during World War II to try to deflect the Nazi attacks, and it worked on a few occasions, from my understanding.
Yeah, the cone of power. So I heard that term 20 years ago. I've heard it much, much less in recent years. But it was the idea of when you cast the circle and in the ritual of when the coven meets and you're doing your ritual, the cone of power is that sort of like central hub of intention, as everybody is trying to raise energy for and ultimately direct it toward the ultimate goal of that ritual, frequently healing. Sometimes healing the group, sometimes healing the world around them. Sometimes it's simply to just raise the energy to increase your ability to perceive and connect with spirits, the ancestors, the land under your feet. And again, cone of power was a term that I was really familiar with, say, in like the early 90s. And I don't really hear many folks talking about it anymore, because our conversation about energy and intention has evolved, not just within the witchcraft community, but among all of the folks who practice magic or the equivalent, and they just don't call it magic.
Right. It's the magic of being, right? And what once was considered magic is now considered science, the combining of elements to create something new. That's all magic. That was magic. That was the sorcery of what was taking place, the illusion, the hand, you know, hand and eye mystification. But here we are in a new age, in a new realm, and it gets purdied up and called self-affirming and affirmations and intention. But the power of prayer is nothing but witchcraft.
Yeah. I mean, they all function on the same mechanics.
Right.
just think of quantum mechanics, where we know for a fact, we've had experiments where human observation and expectation of a result influences reality. There's a fairly classic experiment where they've got individual photons of light going through either slot A or slot B, and the expectation of the observers will determine which one it goes through. And that truth that we've found in quantum mechanics is essentially what people lay claim to be able to do in any aspect of magic. Something in my ability to exert my will can sometimes influence reality, maybe in small ways, but there's still an influence.
What can you tell us about the connection between witchcraft and ghosts and communication with spirits? Is there, and has there always been, that connective tissue as well?
Yeah, and when I first started to get involved in paranormal, actually in the broad paranormal community, you were there really when I started to dip my feet into the paranormal. It was UNIFCON 2006. It was when I met you, Hans Holzer, a ton of people. And I was very much a pagan and a practitioner of magic and occultist who's just sort of like looking at everyone in that community going, no one has any clue that they're doing all the same things that we do. Let's open a dialogue. So spirit communication is a significant part of most witches and other magical practitioners, daily existence. They believe in the survival of the soul after death. While they may not believe that it necessarily goes to heaven, many Wiccans believe in the Summerlands, but they also believe in reincarnation. So you may have a ghost who lingers, or you may have someone who comes back as, you know, your nephew at some point. But you still have the ability and the right to communicate with them, as long as you're doing it with respect. Samhain, Halloween, is one of the eight holidays, major holidays on the wheel of the year, practiced by most folks who identify as witches, Wiccans, and pretty much most pagans and modern magical practitioners. And the main point of that holy day is a feast of souls. It is a time when you honor the ancestors. And actually on Salem Live, I took the opportunity when I was burning the incense, I recited a very small abbreviated version of that to honor the blessed dead, the mighty dead, and invite the ancestors to communicate with us. On one hand, good stuff to do when you're a paranormal investigator. On the other hand, it's what you do in October as a witch.
Now, during Salem Live, the Newkirks from the Amazon series Hellier, they used a sigil. And yep. I know there's still some confusion. What exactly is a sigil? Is that part of witchcraft? And how does it work?
So a sigil is... sigil magic is becoming much more popular among witches and most magical practitioners. It's something Austin Osman Spare is one of the main writers who kind of established this type of magic. But it goes back to that textual magic that I referred to, where people would create, they would either use letters or combinations of letters, or sometimes creating images that were new and unique. And that image was basically shorthand language, a visual bit of language to focus an intention. It is built on the same mechanics magically as a Benedict medal, or honestly, most of the Catholic medals. So you use a symbol. That symbol represents your intention. The symbol itself doesn't exactly have the magic. It is, in a lot of ways, a psychological trigger to remind you powerfully of what you are trying to accomplish. It gives you a focus.
People were being affected by that sigil. People at home were claiming that they were smelling things in their home, and many people were smelling the same things or hearing the same things. Is this a psychological aspect? Because it's what's the word I'm looking for when you kind of imprint on somebody or give them, you front load them with, you know, the fact that there's something there. Or is it truly opening some kind of informational portal?
Well, the hard part with that is, personally, I don't think you can take psychology out of magic, or any psychic experience for that matter. It's happening in our heads, and so how our heads work significantly impact it. And in fact, the psychology of the powerful psychology of having a symbol for everyone to be focusing on at the same time is part of the magic of sigil work. It's relying on the way our psychology works. Now, was it, I know the word that you're looking for, and of course, because you blanked on it, I've also blanked on it. not psychosomatic, but the power of suggestion. Like,
right, that's it, right.
Were people reacting to that as the power of suggestion? I can't rule that out because I think some people do. And I think that that's something that it's important to be aware of as a factor whenever we're doing investigations, because sometimes if somebody starts itching because they walked through a spider web, everybody who's afraid of spiders is going to suddenly like worry that they got a spider on them. I mean, that's a very normal human thing to do. But there's intriguing ideas of power, of like just the power of the human mind and enough people focusing on the same thing all at once. I mean, that's why we do like national days of prayer. It's the same concept. It's just packaged differently.
We have to take just a moment to recognize real magic, Tim. Real magic is around us. What am I talking about? How about free TV? Pluto TV is a leading free streaming television service. You can watch over 100 TV channels, thousands of movies, all on demand for free. I don't think it's just on demand, Tim. You're conjuring these movies up. It's a click of a button and poof, you can watch your favorite movies. Poof, watch your favorite television shows. It's just that easy. It's not black magic. It's not white magic. It's just magic, man. Check it out. No credit card needed. How is that possible? I already told you, people, it's magic. Why aren't you paying attention? There's no sign up. Pluto TV is easy, and it's a completely legal way for you to watch your favorite TV shows and your hit movies. What are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again. Screw the man. Download Pluto TV for free on all of your favorite devices today. Your phone, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, your Apple TV, your Cauldrons, your smart TVs, PlayStations, hell, anywhere else that you can stream. Get Pluto TV. You can thank your buddies from Beyond the Darkness after you do. Michelle, the spirit realm seemed very agitated when we did the Salem Live. There's so much energy in that town, yes, and the surrounding area, Ipswich and Salem and such, because of what took place there. And the fact that it's constantly, like, it's a scab that's constantly being picked. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but there's this constant irritation because people are there doing this. And you have spell workers that are calling upon these spirits. Does that lash the spirits of these beings to our planet because so many people call on them? Or have they, as you mentioned earlier, talking about thought form creation, have we created new versions of Giles or John Proctor or Elizabeth Proctor, any of these beings that were part of this?
Well, first, the one thing I've noticed with people who do like regular witchcraft rituals or any magical rituals is it has a tendency to thin the veil. I mean, that's the purpose of casting a circle and raising that cone of power, is you're creating this focused space where it's easier for there to be communication and a crisscross between the physical world and the non-ordinary world, the spirit world. And think about how many witches and how many rituals and how many bits of actual real magic are going on in that area. And you've got this sort of like cauldron of energy that is happening all year round, and especially in October, to significantly thin the veil, to really like make it easier for things to step across and interact with us. And that doesn't even count for, I do truly believe that sometimes we can create things, either intentionally, more often unintentionally, when enough people believe in the shape of a certain thing. And I think pop culture plays a huge role in that. I've got a pet project. I really want to see how many haunted hotels had little creepy girls in them running up and down hallways before Stanley Kubrick's The Shining came out.
Right. But damn it, you've been to the Stanley. I've been to the Stanley. I've heard children playing in the hallways.
And the question is, are they real or are they Memorex?
Right. Or are they something that's been created because of the mental projection of thousands of players that have been in that area expecting to see things?
Yeah, and at what point does that become a genuine spirit anyway? When at what point is it spirit AI? There's a lot of witches, Wiccans, pagans, believe that they follow the old pagan gods. Some of them literally believe that they're worshiping those, but some of them believe what they are worshiping, like what they are focused on, are archetypes, are collective human projections of anthropomorphized forms, that they're not exactly, that basically we created those gods and they're real now, but they started off as thought forms because people believed in them, and it's belief that shapes them and sustains them. And I'll extend it from like gods, because that's kind of a weird kind of like spooky area to like really delve into. But if you think about how many people want to believe that there's a Slender Man at this point, and then people start to report having experiences with what we know started off as a creepypasta, but it takes the shape of what people expect. They're starting to create that boogeyman.
All right. So here's something then. If that's the case, okay, kids, parents, be aware that I'm going to bring up something right now that some of you may not want your children to know quite about yet regarding some holiday people. So I'll give you a second to tune out or to get your kids distracted by something else.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Every holiday season that rolls around, there is a character associated with it. There are millions of children around the world. And let's face it, where magic lies is in the eyes of children. Mm-hmm. Why aren't we seeing a jolly old elf in red appearing outside our windows or walking in our homes? If this thought projection, this idea and concept is so strong and palpable in such a large portion of our population.
Well, it's one day out of the year. Kids aren't supposed to actually see them. And I think if adults heard something creeping around, knocking on the ceiling or in the chimney on that particular night, the image is so widespread, we're just going to shrug it off, laugh at ourselves for believing in Santa, and go to bed.
Oh, right. I guess I see that. Now, you know, I talked to Chris Fleming, Tim. Remember when we talked to him about the Easter Bunny thing that he saw?
Yeah. Yep. Oh,
right. Chris Fleming, and I'm not laughing because I think he's ridiculous. It was something he saw. He woke up and saw this giant rabbit on Easter, and he talked about it and how it impacted him. And is it something, again, this thought projection, this concept of what is magic? Did he see the Easter Bunny? I will tell you this. I still have an experience from when I was around 9-10 years old. I loved the Lone Ranger so much, Michelle.
Dude, you and me both. I've got a big old scar on the back of my head from going hi-ho silver on a rocking horse. I feel you.
So all I wanted was the Lone Ranger and Silver large action figures. We used to call them dolls. Now they're action figures, so it's cooler. And the Tonto and Scout. And every place I saw that Santa was making an appearance, one of his helpers, I made my parents stop so I could go in and tell Santa. And then we did the family Christmas party. And every year we knew it was one of our dumbass uncles or even my dad dressed up as Santa to hand out presents. And the one year I couldn't identify who the hell Santa was. And the beard wasn't fake. It was a fat old man with a beard. And I looked around this room and I couldn't figure it out. I knew Santa existed, but I couldn't figure out who the hell was playing him at this party. And then he reached into his bag and out comes Silver and the Lone Ranger. And magic was alive for me that day. I must have believed, you know, actively in the jolly old elf until I was in my 30s. Only when you become a parent and realize how much money you have to pour out and somebody else gets the accolades for it, does it start to wear on you? But that was a magical moment for me. But it just does seem funny that there are so many people focused on things and you see the power of prayer and intention happen. But maybe that's what the concept of something like a Santa Claus is. The power of good, doing good things, being responsible and this. It sounds like a mantra again. So what you're doing is you're teaching and you're creating the spirit of what a Santa Claus is. It isn't that it's a physical being, but it's a sense of feeling.
Yeah, it's that... that giving, and that sense of wonder. Like, to me, really, the power of magic, why we should even allow for it in our reality, is it gives us the possibility of wonder, the chance that maybe reality doesn't, that it's not as bleak as we fear, that it actually can be as amazing as we hope.
We have to take a quick break. We've got more to talk about. Our guest, Michelle Bellanger, we have a link up for her website. You can go check it out right on today's podcast. We'll be back. Stay tuned. You're listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Pro wrestling fans, listen up. WWE Hall of Famer and one of the greatest to ever step between the ropes, Jerry the King Lawler, is coming to Podcast One with the Jerry Lawler Show. Join the King and his co-host, Sean Reedy, as they get together to reflect on Jerry's legendary career from Memphis to the WWE to just about everywhere else. The King will share his thoughts on the current wrestling product and might even have a few guests stop by. Download new episodes of the Jerry Lawler Show every Friday on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One. And if you love the show, tell your friends and leave a rating and review.
Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back to the program. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. Don't forget to join us this Tuesday for a brand new edition of True Crime Tuesday. What's that, you ask? What the hell's wrong with you people? We've been doing True Crime Tuesday for 8 years. You need to ask what True Crime Tuesday is? Well, lucky, I will tell you about it anyway. True Crime Tuesday is the best in true crime talk radio. And this week, we're going to be talking with George Jared, Whispers Willows. We're going to talk about the death of Rebecca Amanda, a very strange story. Make sure that you're here for that Tuesday. How do you listen? How do you subscribe? Well, you can go to darknessradio.com, and all of the links to all of the shows that we're a part of are there. You can find ways to subscribe and listen for $5 a month. It'll give you access to the best in true crime talk radio 4 times a month. You get brand new episodes every Tuesday. Not only do we delve into some of the weirdest, creepiest, and most unusual true crimes, but we lighten it up with some dumb crimes, stupid criminals reporting on your stories from around the United States. And if you've got some dumb crimes and stupid criminals in your area, email me their stories at dave@darknessradio.com. We want to hear about the dumb people in your area too. But go subscribe now. $5 a month, that's all it costs, and it gives you access to over 200 past episodes, most 90 minutes to 2 hours long. That's a lot of content for $5 a month. Go subscribe. Try it for a month. If you don't absolutely love it, shut up and just keep subscribing because we need your money. Let's just be honest, Tim. That's what it really boils down to. But you're going to love it. How do I know you're going to love it? Because we're doing spell work on you right now, and we put on a show. We've got great guests. We've got great content, and it's available for you every Tuesday. Go subscribe. It's at Patreon, patreon.com/truecrimetuesday, all one word. You'll find our page there. Go subscribe. Help support your buddies, Dave and Tim, so that we can continue to bring you programming like that and like this, the best in paranormal talk radio. Today, our guest, Michelle Bellanger, and we're talking about witches, witchcraft, magic, the spell work. And are there current people that are looked upon as highly as past, and I apologize for not knowing the names of major witches in the circles, but I mean, are there big names now that are writing new books, writing new stories that really do help move this thing in an evolutionary way, not just a pop culture way?
Absolutely.
Beside you, of course, Michelle. I'm asking, who are the, you know, who are the big Anton LaVey's of the time, and the, you know, and I, again, might be a poor choice, but I'm just saying, you know, the big names associated with this craft.
Well, for some of the older venerable elders, Laurie Cabot of Salem is definitely one who's got a long reaching legacy, and she's still alive. She's not an ancestor yet. Oberon Ravenheart Zell, and his wife, who's passed away, sadly, Morning Glory Ravenheart. And they were the founders of Church of All Worlds. They're over in California. But what I've loved to watch are the newer generations of folks who are writing and like really making this a fantastic living tradition. So you've got Christopher Penzack, who is one of the founders of the Temple of Witchcraft, and that's up in Salem, but New Hampshire. Very good friend, and I highly recommend his work. He is one of the foremost authorities and voices in the whole witchcraft movement. Ivo Dominguez, Devin Hunter is one of the newer, younger folks. Matt Oren, not to just exclude the ladies, Laura Tempest, Zach Croft is another. There's so many. Misha Magdalene. The thing about the modern witchcraft movement and everything that is adjacent to it is there are so many different ways in which it's expressed. So one book will not do you. And, you know, if you run into an author who says that their way is the one true way, that ain't how we roll. So really, like, buy a bunch, browse a bunch. There's a great site called sacredtexts.com. And if you can't afford to buy stuff, they have made it their mission to collect the sacred writings of every world religion that they can get their hands on. And so it's not just witches, witchcraft, and occult, but like everything that you need as a resource. So I recommend browsing there, their virtual stacks of resources, and familiarizing yourself with some of the names there too. And, you know, I play a not insignificant role in that as well, as a writer and a founder of a part of the modern magical community. But that's over with the vampires, which is a totally different episode, I suspect.
And yeah, we'd love to dabble in on that, and maybe even visit with you again in a month or so to kind of to touchstone on the different aspects of vampires and the legends and lore. Coming into Halloween, it's always a good time to talk about the witches and the stories, and coming off the heels of Salem. That's why I wanted to connect with you on this and see what your thoughts were overall of the kind of contact and communication that we were getting. I'm curious too on your thoughts on things like the Ouija board, the witch board, the spirit talking board, whatever title you want to give to them. Do you give much credence to that, or do you think there's more human influence than there is spiritual or magical at all involved in communicating that way?
Well, the first thing I'll say is I think the biggest danger with a Ouija board or a spirit board is the fact that it's very easy to unconsciously influence it. So the biggest problem is the fact that it's a highly unreliable thing. It works, in my opinion, largely off of ideomotor response. So mostly, even if you're not consciously pushing it, you're unconsciously pushing it. And that said, as with almost everything we work with in these communities, sometimes there is very legitimate stuff that happens. I have a personal theory that sometimes that unconscious movement of everyone sitting around using that spirit board can be an expression of the sitters, the human beings' ability to perceive the spirits, but they're not comfortable listening to that in a conscious way. So they need something to project the communication outside of themselves, which is essentially what like tarot cards and other sorts of divinatory techniques do. They give you, think of it like a projection screen through which you channel your unconscious perceptions of a realm that you consciously can't accept you can perceive. And I know that sounds really circuitous, but the bottom line for me with Ouija boards and spirit boards is you have to 100% trust the people who are sitting with you on it if you are even going to experiment with it. You have to trust yourself to catch yourself if you are being influenced by your expectations or your fears. And whenever I've used them personally, and I have, I make certain that the person for whom the questions are relevant, the person who would actually have the answers, is not sitting on the board. They don't have their hands on anything. They stand to the side. They take the notes. They ask the questions. People who don't have a stake in the questions are the ones who sit on it. And that if actual information that those sitters couldn't possibly know comes through, then and only then, in much the same way I measure psychic abilities, then and only then do I think that maybe there's legitimate conversations going on.
That's great insight. Where do you think this is going to continue to grow? Do you think because people are kind of falling out of standard religious edicts and belief systems that things like witchcraft and magic, do you think that that'll continue to grow? And are there, you know, I've heard Kabbalah is kind of how do I say this? I don't want to piss off religious sects, but I mean, it's kind of a version of witchcraft. I mean, are there other versions throughout each religion that kind of align with the concepts of witchcraft?
In every religion, there is the lay religion, which is practiced by, we'll call the masses. It's an impolite word, but it's the, you go to wherever your worship is, you're told what your beliefs should be. You kind of do your workaday religion, but you don't really like have much experience of the divine or the extraordinary. You're paying lip service to it mostly. And then there is the mystical aspect of the religion. And every single religion and religious system has its mystics and its mystical ways of having an unmediated interaction with the divine, whatever we want to call that, God, Yahweh, the goddess, the flying spaghetti monster. Mystics are what we're calling witches in so many words or less. They are the people who seek an unmediated experience, seek the wonder, don't necessarily listen to the rules that are laid down in any books. They go with what they have experienced, and they seek those experiences, and they sometimes reach beyond what we would expect this world to have as boundaries. And again, every religion has them. The poet Rumi, who was Muslim and would just, he was a dervish. You know, you hear the whirling dervishes. He was a mystic. And again, this was something that I studied in my, my master's work in religious studies. The language of people who have mystical experiences across religions have those experiences in a way that crosses religious boundaries. They all perceive the divine and spirits and the human experience in very similar words. Of ecstasy and love and this sort of union and the fact that our souls, our spirits have a bigger impact on our lives and on our worlds than we give them credit for. And that none of those things can really be mediated or dictated to us in a single book. So I think as we move forward, as we dialogue more, we're going to find that we all have way more in common then we have things that separate us if we're willing to experience that wonder.
Let me ask, before we wrap up here today, being in all the places you've been and putting yourself in there, being open to the psychic realm, have you ever been frightened? And if so, what was that encounter like?
Oh, well, I have a very different bar for what scares me because I spent the first 5 years of my life in hospitals being told I would die by the time I was five. So if you ever see that I don't have a startle response, it's because I've already been through quite a lot. The things that have scared me most have always been living people. There have been a few instances with spirits where I'm like, I'm not sure what that is. It seems really effing big, and I don't trust my ability to actually fight it off if it decides to pick a fight with me. And I think that that's less fear and more just, discretion is the better part of valor. And that the one time where I saw something that I'm like, I don't know what the F this is, and I don't want to tangle with it, was a case on Paranormal State in Rochester, New York, that to my knowledge, never actually made it to become an episode. The residents were claiming that it was demonic. I'm not sure what I would call it, but it was big and it was nasty and some very weird stuff happened. And I knew better than to go poke my nose in it too far.
So you have a healthy respect and fear of these things as well and know that, you know, you're not what you're capable and what you're not capable of dealing with.
Yeah, I know my limits. I am someone who works in a role of protector for a lot of people. A lot of my training is in psychic self-defense and that's a funky way of saying, basically, I can go toe to toe with a lot of the bad stuff. I know how things attack using energy, using emotions, and I know how to deflect and manage most of those. It's something that played out on Haunted Salem Live. I know how to recognize when somebody's in a bad place and when what they're going through is going to cascade and just wreck the thing for everybody and how to manage, de-escalate, and then remove them from it. And I also know when I'm in over my head.
If people are interested in exploring and looking into creating a new psychic world for themselves, maybe getting into this, what is a good starting off point for people?
Oh, wow. If you like books, because not everybody is a reader. There's a new book that came out actually by one of the folks who was consulted for Haunted Salem Live. His name is Matt Oren, and he wrote a book called The Psychic Witch. And I really like it because it is something that treads the line between what we're talking about with witches and witchcraft and more familiar experiences for at least some of our paranormal folks of psychic experience and energy work. And he's sort of helping to translate between the two because they're basically, most of the experiences are the same. We're just using different language. It's something that I've been trying to do for years with books like the Psychic Energy Codex. But I think things have definitely moved forward and evolved in a way that is more accessible through Matt's work. I mean, other things, there's podcasts all over the place. We are at a time where there's just a wealth of knowledge. And the only trick is to trust your bullcrap meter. And if your bullcrap meter is going off, that's probably not the resource for you.
What kind of in closing as well, just kind of talk about the bum rap that witchcraft has gotten. When people start hearing, oh, there were animal sacrifices, this was taking place, that was taking place, so it's, somebody's performing witchcraft rituals. What do you make of those claims? Because it seems it's such an earthy religion and, you know, don't do harm unto others. Where do you think, you know, that comes in when it comes to the animals aspect as well?
Well, I can tell you for sure that if somebody is claiming that there's animal sacrifice, that is almost, I can guarantee that's not a Wiccan, and it is highly unlikely for it to be a witch or other practitioner of magic. A lot of the accusations are really things that still hang over our heads from the witch trials. Witches were accused of sacrificing animals. They were accused of sacrificing infants. They were accused of having basically great big orgies in the woods and also cavorting with the devil in many forms. And it's interesting that when somebody from the outside is looking in at any kind of magical group and they want to call it a cult, the first things that they will accuse them are echoes of that. They're, you know, orgies, sacrificing babies, sacrificing animals. And 9 out of 10 times, that is completely just people making stuff up because they don't know what's going on. And that 10th time, it might be voodoo, Santeria, a number of the other African diaspora religions where animal sacrifice does play a role, and it is something that is a significant part of how that religion is expressed and is no different from slaughtering animals, say, in a kosher way to eat them, because the animals that are sacrificed in that, you know, these are religions that are actually taking the death of the animal and preparing it for food and making that part of their sacred act. So even animal sacrifice, as much as like it's not something I would participate in, what you need to know is find out more. Like find out like what are they actually doing. Don't just let rumors make you perpetuate more rumors. Go to the source and ask them, what are you doing? What do you practice? What do you believe?
All right. And then with that said, the whole concept of working with the devil, is there a specific point in history where you see that that became part of the connection? Why do people, or was that just a religious kind of aspersion that was cast upon them that because they're doing this, they must be in league with the devil? Or, you know, was there dark practitioners that would be in league with Satan?
Broadly speaking, during the witch craze, the belief was that no one could work magic or miracles without the help of either God. And if they were not clergy, God couldn't be doing it. Therefore, it had to be the devil. So the idea of a witch forming a pact, signing the black book, that was the excuse for her having any ability to work magic at all. Now, that's not the case. You know, modern witches believe that everybody has access to magic, that magic is alive and it's in the world and it's in us. Are there people who worship something like a satanic deity? Yes. I mean, there's, well, first of all, the Church of Satan, Levian Satanists don't actually worship Satan, and that confuses a lot of people. But there are theistic Satanists, and there are some satanic witches. But it's important to understand that even then, their idea of Satan is more sort of the popularized image of Lucifer as the eternal rebel. The simplest way of understanding it is most of the people who believe in Satan are Christians.
All right. All right. That's a good concept. Now, with that said, one of the last shows that's now kind of blown up in the public is the kind of reboot of Sabrina, the Teenage Witch.
Mm-hmm.
And this now really does play into that dark aspect. Is it shows like this that are doing a lot of damage, or do you think most people realize this is just for entertainment value?
Oh, I've watched the witches in my like social circle kind of go back and forth about that. On one hand, they're a little cranky that it's making all the witches look like witches from the Middle Ages who are, you know, their magic comes through Satan, and that's just patently wrong. And at the same time, there's some subversive use of pop culture images that Sabrina is using. And, you know, there's definitely a school of thought within the witchcraft movement currently of, you know, why not test some of that? Why not, like, turn it on its ear? Why not just, and also it's fiction, so really just tell the story. I'm on the fence with it because I know the power of pop culture. And when, you know, so many of our ideas of, like, how you deal with possession and exorcism can be traced back to 1973 and the movie The Exorcist. Heck, people's approaches to Ouija boards really go back to that, like the idea that they're going to get you possessed. So even if it is fiction, it does influence popular imagination and public opinion. So I've got some mixed feelings about Sabrina personally and the impact that she'll have, and the show in general will have on people's expectations of what witches actually do.
Well, Michelle, it's always great to catch up with you. I know it's been about 5-6 years. I'm glad that we were able to reconnect in Salem and get you back on the show. But let's not wait that long. Let's get you back and talk vampires and other cool, spooky legends and lore real soon. Would you do that?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Thank you all for tuning in. We'll be back again with you on Tuesday, True Crime Tuesday. Don't miss out on that. And we'll be back again next weekend with more of the best in Paranormal Talk Radio. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This Labor Day, say goodbye to spills, stains, and overpriced furniture with WashableSofas.com. Featuring Anabay, the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly pricing. Sofas start at just $6.99, making it the perfect time to upgrade your space. Anabay's pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and interchangeable slip covers are made with high-performance fabric built for real life. You'll love the cloud-like comfort of hypoallergenic, high-resilience foam that never needs fluffing, and a durable steel frame that stands the test of time. With modular pieces, you can rearrange any time. It's a sofa that adapts to your life. Now through Labor Day, get up to 60% off site-wide at WashableSofas.com. Every order comes with a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping, no restocking fees, every penny back. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.